And Eamon, does Wes, does he fix it all?
He doesn't fix the whole thing, but I think...
It makes a statement, though,
it makes a statement.
Here's Houlihan. Oh, it's a lovely ball. And Robbie Keane! Gibraltar carved open. Robbie Keane for Wes Houlihan. Still has it, Houlihan. Had to score, and did. Nothing more than Houlihan deserves.
Should be always room in squads, even. Mostly in teams.
Oh, lovely.
For players like that. Players who see different things.
Why didn't you think that Wes Houlihan could have done a job for you in midfield at that point to hold on to possession of the football?
All option was now, after 90 minutes, you can say what you want.
There are lots of things wrong, but you do send a signal when you leave an outstanding player like him off the team. And when you, it's a kind of insult.
Houlihan has just scored a brilliant goal for the Republic of Ireland 3 minutes into the second half.
Miss Coleman to stand it up. Houlihan!
You love it. That's got past on his goal! Wes Houlihan!
Pushes back to the edge of the penalty. Houlihan!
Good.
The Swedish defender jumped, he missed it, and Houlihan was coming in at the back post. First time volley, smashed it past Isaksson in the Swedish goal. It's been coming, it's fully deserved, and Ireland leads Sweden by a goal to nil.
We'll always have Paris Wes, we'll always have Paris. Wes Houlihan has announced his retirement from international football. It feels like he's only just started in many ways. He has only just started. Stewie Byrne, the man who taught him everything he knows, is alongside us.
Yeah, looked after him.
Richie's here as well. I got to say, I was a little bit surprised when the news came in because we had spoken at, I think it might have been the Moldova game, where I was making the point that like we're getting towards the very end of Wes. At that stage, it may have been the last time we saw him at the Aviva. And you were suggesting that actually, because he had to wait so long, 31 by the time he made his competitive debut, that really, he might give it a go for another campaign, that Ireland was everything for him.
Yeah, I was making the point, he's been really good with injuries. And like he came to the fore late on, really, in terms of his conditioning, has really looked after himself in the last 10 years or so. And just kind of, because of the style of football that he plays, he hadn't picked up any serious knocks, hadn't had any serious injuries. And also because the country loved him. You know, he was becoming this, not just a cult hero, but a real genuine hero to the country. Like, you know, and of course, the goal against Sweden, you know, topped it all off. And I felt that would have been enough to keep him going. And I remember I had a very short conversation with him around this about 6 months ago. And I kind of threw it out there as if to suggest, don't be thinking about retiring. I was trying to cheer him up a little bit, you know, making references to the likes of Totti and Maldini, you know, because those guys look after themselves, they play into their 40s, and I don't see any reason why he couldn't do that himself. And so I thought that was going to happen because everything was quite quiet for the last, you know, since the game against Denmark, it was all quiet. I was beginning to think, you know what, maybe he's starting to think that he might stay on for a little while longer. However, I think, you know, and I haven't spoken to him about this, but I think he may have had mixed thoughts about his role in the team. I think there might have been a lot of confusion there, especially in the last few games. And I think we all got the sense that the Denmark game, something came to a head in that game. You know, remember the frustration of the players in that game, and you just kind of felt something wasn't right in the camp. And that may have been the sort of catalyst to say, you know what, probably time to go now.
Was the management ticket sticking around and the timing of their announcement, given that was what, 2-3 weeks ago at this stage, and Wes has decided to call it a day, do those two things correlate at all?
I can't answer for him, but I can tell you what I was thinking in my head. I was, if Martin O'Neill had taken the job or had gotten the job at Stoke, and depending on who would have come in, I think it may have swayed him to stay. That's only a guess. It's a pure guess, and you know, it's not right to kind of speak on his behalf, but you know, from very little I've spoken to him, I think it has been in his head since the Denmark game. Like, you know,
yeah.
So, but why did he take until now to make that decision?
Well, I guess, like, we haven't heard from Glenn Whelan, we haven't heard from John O'Shea. Maybe all these players are just waiting to see all where they're going to be with their club game. Remember, it's 2.5 years before Euro 2020, which is probably also in Wes's mind that, yeah, I feel okay now when I'm 35. I'm going to be 36 very soon. By the summer of 2020, I'll be 38. Like, do I want to put the effort in now if I'm not going to be around to enjoy home games at the Aviva Euro 2020?
I think that's it. I think you have to know where your place is in a team, and you have to. Footballers are no different to anyone. They have, you know, you have to feel wanted, like, you know. And if you don't feel like that's there, okay, maybe it's there in some element, but if you're getting mixed messages from, you know, from supporters, from the crowd, from the media, especially, and it's been difficult for him to be able to manage that, because, I mean, pretty much for the last 5 or 6 games, it's all about him, you know, and he's got to deal with that. Now, when he doesn't play, he's got to deal with that as well. But I would say that what has been key for him is to accept his role now, you know, and how he's best utilised. And that's something that he's doing at club level. He's best utilised, you know, bringing him off the bench 30 minutes, 35 minutes, full of energy, a little bit of guy, you know, even just... going back to the recent the FA Cup game against Chelsea, done exactly that at Stamford Bridge, kind of galvanised the team, and probably something they should have got out of it. But
we seem to go the other way now with Ireland in the last 20-25 minutes. Rather than looking for some guile and looking for some control, we just go traditional, big man, get it long, get it high, get forward as quick as we
can. And that's it. There's a huge contrast there of styles of play. And he, Wes plays a certain way. To be quite honest with you, you know, if you were to do it all over again, you'd have Wes Houlihan in as a 24-25-year-old in the middle of your team, and you would build your team around him. Unfortunately, it has all happened too late for him. But in saying that, I think...
How much of that was down to Wes? Because Wes has admitted himself that during those years with Shells, like, he didn't realise what it took to be a professional footballer. He thought... He was almost like,
he was that good, he could.
But also, maybe that just delayed his progress those few years beyond his 23, 24, 25.
Yeah, well, he had to do things the hard way. You know, when you left Shells in 2005, it was Livingston, I think it was. Something was 50 grand at the time. And I think it was one of them situations where he had to go at the time. You know, that probably wasn't the best move in the world for him.
He just needed to rip himself away from that situation.
Yeah, do something different. He needed to get out of you know, our situation, and he needed to, you know, get into a kind of a different environment. Maybe going to Livingston probably set him back a year or two, because you know just by the sheer nature of where it is, you're kind of isolating yourself. You're out of the picture a little bit. It was the move to Blackpool that I think really. Threw him into light there. You know, I mean, they voted him as the best player that's ever played at Blackpool since Stanley Matthews or something. They absolutely adored him, like, you know. And then moving on to Norwich, of course, and he did all his best stuff at Norwich, you know, especially in the Premier League. But he's had to do it the hard way. And for anybody who ever thinks of Wes as being some sort of a comfort player or whatever, like, you know, he has that graft in him.
That was one of the sort of myths perpetrated by Trapattoni that we've seen over the last few years. And just on the Martin O'Neill thing, in case people are taking us up the wrong way, like, Wes speaks very well in the interview that he did with Aidan Fitzmaurice in the Indo today. And he speaks very highly of Martin O'Neill and Martin O'Neill giving him that opportunity. And I guess if Martin O'Neill had gone to Stoke, there's no guarantees that the conversation with the new manager would have been any different than the conversations he was having with Martin O'Neill as to what his role would be within the team. But Trapattoni, and even watching back some of the press conferences today where he spoke about Wes, sort of put out this myth that Wes didn't work hard enough. Show is show, result is result, and Wes was a player for the show. But ultimately, he couldn't really trust him. He didn't have the graft. He wouldn't get stuck in when it really mattered. If there was one thing we've seen about Wes that probably surprised people when you watch him live, is Wes put himself about a bit.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing about that, Nathan, is that you know, when a man like Trapattoni comes in, and okay, I know it didn't end very good, but he came in with a huge profile, huge experience in the game. So people sort of drew on his every word, you know, and a man like that, a man with that kind of experience and profile in world football, can convince a lot of people. And you know what? I actually think he did convince a lot of people, and he probably threw doubts into Wes's head at the time. We know now that he was just talking total nonsense, to be quite honest, genuine, you know, dead simple. And that was a big setback for him as well, of course. Huge setback for him. That's probably the maybe the biggest regret he'll have in an Ireland jersey. That's the difference between him, you know, getting over those 50 caps, I suppose. Yeah. Then again, I don't
think... He can't have regret over that.
You're right, Richie.
He can't have regret over the best period in his club career, be it at Blackpool and then Norwich, coinciding with somebody whose idea of football was diametrically opposed to his.
Yeah.
Like he can't have regret over that. He can be disappointed that, you know, he just happened to come along at that stage, or his game progressed to such a level that he would have been gaining international caps at that stage. But he can't feel regret about it.
No, he won't. And to be fair to him, he's the opposite of critical. He's a wonderful attitude, and like to see this stuff. He can't do this stuff because he doesn't like to speak bad of anybody. And when you said to me that, you know, he spoke very highly of Martin, I completely believe that, and I genuinely, you know, I know he believes that as well. He's just very much of the attitude that you kind of get up and get on with things, like, you know, and that reflects in how he plays, because I think remembering the couple of instances recently where I can't remember the game when we were away in the qualifiers, and remember that he kind of came on, he had a wonderful chance inside the box, and everyone thought, oh no, I think he's tried to pass it to Robbie Brady when he should have gone and shot himself, and everyone's thinking, oh, his head is gone. But I know it's not, because he doesn't let things affect him.
But he showed that more than anywhere that night in Lille, where he missed the opportunity against Italy, and Jonathan Pearce of the BBC had this brilliant line in commentary of, Wes has missed the chance of a lifetime.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It felt like that. And within 5 minutes, he's playing one of the most delicious balls an Irish footballer has ever played onto Robbie Brady's head.
Yeah.
He did seem to have that magical ability to just put things out of his mind instantly.
Yeah, and I think that's his nature. It's just he can just blank things out, and on the positive side, that means that he can go and play and do wonderful things like he does. On the negative side, means that, you know, he might make a very good pundit. Yeah. I don't think he wants to be.
Eamon Dunphy was on Radio 1 earlier, and Des Cahill had to point out that Wes isn't dead. There's nothing seriously wrong with Wes. But text us in your thoughts, 53106. When did you first see him play?
Oh.
Did you know instantly, this guy's got something about him?
Do you know what? He's the reason why I got my first sending up, my first red card in Talcott Park. Yeah, I was playing for Longford. I'd seen him play a couple of times beforehand, but didn't realise how good. I remember playing in Talcott Park, seeing this little season, I think he was 16 at the time, 17, you know, max 17, and we went down to 10 men, and I got pushed back centre half and whatever, and I remember he got the ball out on the right hand side, and I went over to close him down, and I'd had enough of him because he was just running riot, and I said I just lost it, and I went to lash him, and I just completely missed him. he was gone. I was red carded off, gone.
Oh, sickener.
Yeah, sickener. So but from that night on I kind of respected him, like, you know.
Lots of texts coming in. Watched Wes against Deportivo in 2004 in the Champions League. They were one of the top sides in Europe at the time. They could not get near Wes and some of those Spanish players had played in the Euros a month earlier.
Well, I had the best seat in the house that night, and I remember I've often said this, like, that you know, my role that night was obviously to nullify Valeron, and so I'm running around like a headless chicken just watching this guy. But I just, anytime I got the ball, I just gave it to him. 5 yards here, there you go. I'm just watching this kid going, this is ridiculous. Like, you know, I mean, I had the best seat in the house. He was just unbelievable that night.
Yeah. So a lot of people go back to that sort of time when he is, what was he then, 22, 23, as to maybe he should have been getting call-ups for the international side then, when Brian Kerr was in charge. Don Givens
gave him a run of Glenn Crowe. I think was it Greece or Crete?
Greece, yeah. He didn't get a game.
He had the game he was in charge for two games, but he immediately brought him over because he had him in the 21s and knew how good he was, and he introduced him then.
But was he good enough around that time when he was playing against Deportivo? Like, physically, would he have been good enough?
Yeah, but it's not his game. You know, to be honest, Nathan, I played against players for Stoubuk or Rest, whatever, they're the same height, the same weight, the same physical shape. But these guys know how to use them. They know how to use their core, they know how to use their balance. He was never going to be
a bulky player. Exactly. If you gave him that extra bulk, you'd probably lose what he might have had as a player as well.
And to be quite honest, he was probably a little bit more physically able when he was younger, because he did a lot of weights when he was younger. He really got stuck into the gym. It's only really when he kind of sorted out his diet really, that his conditioning really improved, like, you know, and that's what's given him the longevity to play like he plays.
Oisin and Trim says, your Sultan's a ping tune at the end of the show will be perfect for Wes. Give him a ball in the yard of grass. I watched him play Champions League for Shells back in the day. Was certainly not out of place on the pitch with Deportivo. He's going to leave a gaping hole for those of us who watch Ireland.
Who's
going to
replace him?
Well, that's the thing. There is no next Wes Hoolahan. And I always thought one of Wes's greatest qualities, and listen, we know the range of passing he has, was his ability to do the simple things at the right time. And quite often that was doing nothing. So often we would see Wes pick up the ball in the middle of the pitch and he would just maybe do a little shift to the side, but he would hold on to the ball for 6, 7, 8, 9 seconds, give time for the fullbacks to get forward, give time for everybody else to get in position, which seems simple. But in
made it look simple.
He made it look simple, because the game goes at such a pace. To be able to control the ball dead, take a step to the side, go around one player, and then pick out the right pass and give it to somebody in a better position.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have somebody like that. Look at what Myler was doing against Wales, or Harry Arthur was doing over in Copenhagen. And maybe Harry Arthur, you would think, watching him for Bournemouth, should have that ability. Paying it 50, 60 yards, get rid of it.
But
Wes couldn't do that. Yeah. It wasn't in him.
And here's a point. Without trying to just take away from the abilities of Harry Arthur or James McCarthy, but there's been a lot of talk about James McCarthy, a lot of talk about Harry Arthur. Neither of them can do it at international level, in my opinion, the way the Wes can do it. Mm. I mean, they're the £15 million players, you know, and I mean, yet we're so reliant on Wes to kind of do what you said, just get on the ball in awkward situations, and sometimes not even in awkward situations, just to get us playing, just to get us into that rhythm of stringing passes together. Probably the best part of his game is taking the ball in any situation, because he has this wonderful centre of gravity, wonderful
awareness.
That's
really something we don't do at international football, which is demand the ball when there's an opposition player near you.
And
that didn't bother him.
He instilled confidence in the player to give it to him. Like, a lot of players might, you know, get on the ball and they might have a little look and go, oh, I don't know about that. But when you know it's him on the end of it, it's just, there you go. And you can see that's what he's done for us. And it sounds so simple, but for some reason it's a big difficulty for us when he's not on the team.
Charlie's not having Wes. Can't understand this fascination with Wes Hoolahan. He was more bench player there. Some ridiculous praise today. All these managers can't be wrong.
Yeah, well, I disagree with that. You know, I think what happens is, it's a pressure job. There's no doubt about it. These managers have a look around. They probably come from an environment where they would have utilized more physical players, and they played a certain way. And the likes of Martin O'Neill is a good example. Pretty much has a way of playing, and will stick to that. You know, but to be fair to him, he was a hell of a lot more. He utilized Wes a hell of a lot more than any other manager did as well. Like, you know,
but during the last campaign, he seemed to manage Wes until those last couple of games.
I think he wants to play him, but it just. For some reason, like, the big one probably was playing Callum O'Dowd in the away game against Denmark. You know, I think that might have hurt him a little bit, because that game was pretty much, you know, we just defended for most of it.
Like, that was Trapattoni era type football. It was just hoofing it long.
We were as a team, we were starting to regress at that stage, weren't we? You could just see it. We never really kicked on from the Euros. We were just gradually. We were just ticking along, and we weren't really improving, weren't going that way. We were sort of starting to regress a little bit. And then it all culminated in the home game against Denmark.
The ball for James McLean over in Austria, though. Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing that I think, you know, it's time to celebrate what he's achieved. I remember texting him after the Sweden game. Maybe he hadn't realised it at the time, but I'm just saying, look, that's Houghton in Germany. That's Houghton in Italy. You know, you've got one of them goals. It's you know, you can count them on your hand, the amount of players that have done that in Irish soccer history, and you're one of them. So
did that mean something to him? Thing.
I'd say it did.
Is he the type of character that eventually does sink in, the importance of what he's done?
Oh God, you'd want to be something wrong with you if that didn't sink in, like, you know, and especially he's comes from a football family, and his family are very supportive of him, and of course where he comes from, the inner city and all, like, you know, he's a hero there, like, you know. It was a great day. One of the best, probably one of the best days I can remember. You know, like I say, they're few and far between. And when you consider the Euros of 2012, which were, you know, awful.
Stewie, thanks a lot for coming in. If you're talking to Wes, tell him we love him and we'll miss him.
I will tell him.
Maybe bring him in with you some evening.
I'll try my best.
Off the Ball on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well,
to
do it then.
Come again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Kevin is alongside me in studio. We're going to be joined by Chris Sutton on the line a little bit later on. I'm looking forward to that. One of the good things about these sort of legends interviews is you spend a little bit of time on YouTube. He was a player.
Yeah,
that Celtic team, and I'm not a Celtic supporter.
I am a Celtic supporter, that's the
that
thing.
That Celtic
so.
Team.
Yeah.
Of the sort of mid part of the noughties.
Yeah.
They were a cracking team.
Class, weren't they? We didn't get enough games probably on TV to watch. You might have had a lot here, but usually the games would have been
you were playing.
Yeah, exactly, when you're playing. So you don't get a chance to watch as much football as you would like. But the games you used to watch, certainly the Old Firm games, the big European nights, they were definitely the ones you used to watch, the big European nights. And that side, I just think in my head of those big nights at Celtic Park and that UEFA Cup, wasn't it then? UEFA Cup run to the final in 03, I think it was. And that was the Celtic side that I remember. Larsen, Sutton, Petrov, don't forget Big John. You know, all
don't that like it is.
Yeah, they were even prior to that was always.
Oh, but Larsen, like
yeah, I know.
We all know how good Larsen was, and there was always the conversation about it's the Scottish League, and then he goes to Barcelona and he proves he can do it anywhere.
Mm.
His movement must have been as good as any striker.
Yeah, it was though.
Like his ability
it?
To drop deep and little layoff to Hartson, to Sutton, to one of the midfielders, and get back up and be back in that sort of traditional number nine position again.
I know. And you only need to. I think what makes it even more prominent when you're thinking of Henrik Larsson was when he'd obviously left Celtic, gone to Barcelona, he went back to Sweden, and then he went back on loan to Man United. Mm. And you realise the impact that he had on Man United in such a short space of time and how good he was then. Even. What was he? Probably mid 30s at that stage. I would have thought. Probably, certainly in the twilight of his playing career, but playing for Celtic, yeah. And I think that's the thing that you feel is overlooked at times as well. That how good because Scottish football has had a lot of criticism over the years because we all know. Yeah, it hasn't been as good as the Premier League, largely down to the amount of money that's gone into the game. But Celtic at that time and how good they were actually against the top European sides, that's what you've got to use that Celtic side as a gauge. Have we seen Celtic now dominating domestically? But when it comes to the European games, they can't do it. They can't compete, really. Whereas that Celtic side was seriously competing and beating some of the best.
Yeah, so that is coming up in around about 10, 12 minutes from now. We'll be joined by Chris Sutton. We'll chat about Blackburn, his days with Norwich and all that as well. But there's only really one story in town, just sadness. Sadness around the office, mainly because we now have a massive 15-minute gap every time we talk about Ireland as to what we're going to discuss. Wes Houlihan.
Who's the next player that we can...
This is part of the problem. Like, we've had one of these players. We went from Andy Reid to Wes Houlihan. Yeah. Then like Roy wasn't involved. Well,
Stephen Ireland for a while as well.
Stephen Ireland as well, going all the way back to Lee Brady. Like, right now, there's nobody.
Yeah.
Like, are we going back to Stephen Ireland? Is Stephen Ireland once again going to be the story?
Oh, no, I can't see that. I really can't see that. I mean, we know that we have missed Stephen Ireland. We've missed seeing him develop as an Irish player over the years. But no,
I'd have him back in the squad in March. But listen, we'll get on to that
again.
So Wes turns 36 in May. I imagine part of his thinking is that he's going to be 38 by the time the next European Championship comes around. And like, is he even going to still be playing football? I had hope, though, that he would just give it one more campaign, even if it was for just 15, 20 minute spells.
I think that was probably in all our thoughts. I'm sure it must have been in Martin O'Neill's thoughts that whatever was said during the conversation that they had with each other, Martin O'Neill and Wes, I'm sure that was brought up. I don't know, but I think when you look at it overall, you look at his age and you look at the impact that it has been having maybe on club level over the last few years as well, because he hasn't been a regular starter. We only need to look at when they were playing the Premier League, when they got relegated last season. No, so I think in general, I think he's probably looking at his body and trying to prolong his career and maybe his earning capacity over the next few years. As blunt as that is, that's the way that it is. I know that he would have loved playing for Ireland, and he said it himself that playing for Ireland once was everything to him. That's what all he wanted, was to get one Ireland cap.
Were you surprised in those first 2-3 years of Trapattoni, when you were playing, when you were in the squad, that he wasn't there, that he wasn't involved?
I was a little bit. I'd spoken about that maybe around the time that I initially retired, simply because that we were a functional side. I think everyone knows that would have watched us in the Trapattoni. Very much a functional side, a side where everybody knew the position, everybody knew the role in the side, but there was nothing different. We had no real spark off the bench. We didn't have a player to come off the bench. I mean, you mentioned there Andy Reid. I think there was a surprise amongst us all when Andy Reid was left out after it was Georgia, wasn't it, when we played Georgia in Germany. After that, we all know what happened with Andy Reid. But we didn't have a game changer. We didn't have anyone that can come in and come in and make a difference to the squad. So I think not having Wes, given how well he was playing, certainly, and I know it wasn't at Premier League level then, but given how well he was playing, certainly at Football League level, then yeah, I think it is a bit of a surprise, yeah.
I also thought one of Wes's greatest attributes was his ability to do nothing when he was on the ball at times, and we often lack that. So we've seen in our away games recently, Harry Arthur, David Myler, every time they get it, kick it as far down into the opposition half. Keep hold of it. Yeah. He'd stand there. He had the ability to do a couple of little step overs, just a little shimmy to the side and calm everything down, which you would have thought was something Trapattoni would have realised the importance of.
Yeah, I think at times the way that we have played over the last probably 8-10 years, I suppose, you say, when we've had to play against some of the best sides, we've had to defend deep against teams. The one thing is vital when you get the ball is a ball carrier. And for all that Wes wasn't the sort of player that was dynamic that could go box to box, he'd hold the ball for 10 or 15 seconds at a time. He could easily do that, five seconds at a time. You know what can happen in 5 seconds on a football pitch. And I think in doing that, I think he just he instilled the confidence in the players to make runs off him. He instilled the confidence that players knew that they could give him the ball anywhere on the pitch, even if he was under pressure with a couple of defenders, and then they could move off that. And I think that seems
even more important at international level. I often feel watching on the players don't trust each other to the extent they do at club level.
I think there's a lot of panic that sets in as well. You play. I know it's been discarded by a lot of people, but you can actually see it. There's nervousness, and I've freely admitted this myself. When I was playing at international level, there is a nervousness that you don't get when you're playing for your club. You understand what's at stake, and I think you're spot on with that. I think it is more important, and that's why Wes has been crucial when we've had some big results over the last few years.
Chris Sutton is coming up in a moment. Should mention we've two live games this Sunday as well. Newcastle, Manchester United, 2:15. Bernard O'Toole will be alongside Pat Nevin, and then myself and Gary Breen will be at St Mary's for Southampton against Liverpool. That one kicks off at 4:30. Should mention as well a big night taking place at Greystones United. They are celebrating 30 years since Euro 88 and are taking on the best of Ireland's footballing legends. Ray Houghton, Ronnie Whelan, Tony Cascarino, and many more. Not get the call?
Not been asked, no.
Are you available?
When is it?
Saturday, 24th of February.
It might be.
Could be onto something here.
Well, the next one I'm doing, I'm going to Derry. I'm going to Ryan McBride, his game up in Derry on the Easter weekend. So it's Easter Monday. Yeah, that's when I'm up there in Derry, yeah.
The 2nd of April, I'm going to say. Easter
2nd
Monday.
Of April,
2nd
that's exactly
of
it is,
April.
Yeah.
So go support that. But also go support this for Greystones United. So Houghton, Whelan, Cascarino, they're all going to be there. It's going to be a meet and greet as well with Paul McGrath. So some of Ireland's greatest ever players. There'll be a Legends dinner as well with a question and answer session afterwards at the Parkville Hotel. It is all taking place Saturday, 24th of February. Visit www.guafc.ie. That's guafc.ie. You can book your tickets for what is the ultimate family day out. Chris Sutton is up next.
Herrera, what type of midfielder is Herrera? He's not a box to box, he's not defensive, he can't do a f***ing killer pass. Why is he on the f***ing pitch for what? See him come here and f***ing boss us at Old Trafford. This is Man United talking. See him come here and f***ing boss us. Rojo, what is he? What was his tactics? As soon as you get Rojo, just f***ing do it. We're not f***ing Stoke. We're Man f***ing United here. Watch. That was diabolical, that. Martial, he's playing against a f***ing centre midfielder in doubt. Take the f***ing on. Take him on and f***ing do it. We're Man f***ing United here. That was diabolical, that.
So, Chris Sutton had quite the career. He was on the Norwich team the night Jeremy Goss smashed home that volley against Bayern Munich. His partnership with Alan Shearer fired Blackburn to the Premier League title in 1995. Before a move to Celtic saw him win 4 Scottish Premiership titles as part of one of the all-time great Celtic teams. And I'd like to say Chris is on the line now. Thanks for taking the call, Chris.
No problem at all.
So we thought we'd get straight to it. Who did you make a better player, Shearer or Larson?
You can't ask me that first question. Oh, look, it was actually, I was lucky throughout my career to partner many great strikers, and you know, I have to say, I think that those two were probably the best two. But bearing in mind, I, you know, played with Gianfranco Zola at Chelsea for a while. George Weir, two times World Player of the Year, very briefly. But you know, Shearer and Larson, I played with them for longer spells. And you know, I think what set them apart from other strikers and made them top strikers was their mental strength.
We'll get into Shearer and Larson a little bit more, but going all the way back then to when you first started out, and I mentioned the Jeremy Goss goal being one of the standout moments with Norwich against Bayern Munich. Starting out at Norwich, had you grown up in the town? Was this always the dream as a kid? I know your dad had played for Norwich. Was this what you dreamed about when you were 9, 10, pulling on the Norwich jersey?
Yeah, I don't want to pull you up, but you defend a lot to the farming community. Norwich is actually a city, not the town. I was brought up in the area. I was actually rejected as a youngster from the football club. I went to a thing back then. It was called the Centre of Excellence, which, you know, was the equivalent of the academies now. When I was 12, went on a trial period, was rejected, and then got another chance 3-4 years later, on my last year at school, went down. I did well in a local county competition, got another opportunity, a short trial period, and then I was offered a 2-year apprenticeship, which was a YTS back then. What, 2 years YTS, £29.50 the first year, £35 in the second year, and in that 2-year period, really, where I, you know, I'd come from nowhere, where I really progressed very quickly. But these were the days when you didn't have the big squads which Premier League clubs have nowadays. If you're doing well in the youth team, you got your opportunity in the reserve team. And if the lads who did well in the reserves, they would be the next one into the first team if there were injuries. And that's exactly what happened to me. So within, I think, my second year YTS, I'd made my debut for Norwich City in the first team.
Yeah, Chris, you'd played a lot during your youth and early football as a centre half. I know that I think it was Dave Stringer, wasn't it, that was quite influential to convert you to a striker. That's what we all recognise you as a striker. So how quickly did you adjust then to the role of a striker, or what was it, any one moment that actually influenced Dave Stringer to put you up front?
But he probably wasn't sure which was my best position. He, you know, if you ask him in the early days, he'd probably tell you I was bad at both. So, no, it was just something. I was always a striker growing up through youth football, or, you know, I played once or twice in midfield, and I'd never really played centre-half, but that came about one day in training in the youth team. I think there was an injury to a player, and I played, it was the South East Counties League then, I think it may have been against Spurs we were playing, and I did okay at centre-half, and then that sort of stuck, and I played in the reserves at centre-half, and then I played predominantly under Dave Stringer early on. I played more games as a centre-half than a centre-forward, but I found it was... you know, it was good to play both positions, and really good for my development. And I was lucky to be brought up at a club like Norwich City. I think that they had a lot of boys who they got through the youth system into the first team back then. I think, you know, the pathway was easier then, but they had a very good record of developing young players, good upbringing. You were taught to play, you know, the proper way. On the deck, and I think I was extremely lucky that I was at Norwich City, got my chance in the first team, but then of course you have to take the opportunity when it comes along.
Was it always going to be football for you when you were a kid? Like, your dad had his years at Norwich and ended up retiring from professional football at a young age. Was there ever any backup plan, or was it always, once you were 16, 17, you got into the YTS scheme, that it was football or nothing else?
But it was always in my mind that it was going to be football at a young age. It's all I did. You know, like most of the young lads in the village I was brought up. It was football in the winter, cricket in the summer. And but then when I was rejected at the age of 12 or 13 from Norwich, I didn't think I'd have a career in football. And you know, I got in maybe fortuitously, you know, getting another opportunity late in the day, as it was, before or finishing my school year. And then because I actually had a job at Norfolk County Council, I was supposed to start a job there as a clerk. So heaven knows where that would have that would have taken me. But I got the opportunity to do the apprenticeship, and I never looked back. But certainly through my teenage, the young teens, I didn't expect to be a footballer. But I think a lot of the reason I actually got on was a testament. I owe a lot to my dad, who really, when I say pushed me in the right way physically. You know, he was a PE teacher at the local school. I used to go in and do a lot of circuit training in the morning. You know, a lot of track work, running, and then practicing kicking a ball up against a wall a lot. And look, I wouldn't say I was the most naturally gifted player as a youngster. Many would argue that I wasn't the most naturally gifted when I actually had a career. But I think that a big part of me getting on was, drive and determination, and my father, Mike's influence.
I know, as you pointed out, Norwich is very much a city. Blackburn is very much it's a large town. And I'm just thinking, like, when you went in at Norwich, like, thrown in at the deep end is right. You're very quickly, they're a team challenging for a Premier League title. Mm. You're playing Bayern Munich in the UEFA Cup. And I'm just wondering the similarities of Norwich and Blackburn. I've been around a place where they're not like these giant super clubs, where it really does take over the entire town. Did it make all that success all the more special?
Well, I think I was, lucky to play in Norwich City's greatest era. And, I was a young player. Breaking into the first team, we had that season where we actually could have won the Premier League. I think it was 92-93 season. Mm-hmm. And we just came up short against Manchester United, and Aston Villa, I think, finished above us. We didn't have the belief. I mean, this was a great United team, and you look at, and this was the start of them really kicking on. Schmeichel, Bruce Pallister, Giggs, Cantona, Hughes, Paul Lynch. You know, it's a great United side. But we at never any point during that season did I actually think that the players actually thought we could actually win the league. And but it was, it was good for a smaller club to really, push as we did. And then, of course, the next season, under Mike Walker, we had the European success. Knocking Bayern Munich out of Europe was the biggest moment in Norwich City's history. And that was, it was a wonderful goal from Jeremy Goss. I did a lot of the spade work, though, backing the defender, who headed it back 30 yards out, and Goss volleyed it in. So I don't know whether you count that as an assist. I suppose you would.
The way that club and that team then was sort of being dismantled over that last couple of years, did that make the decision when Kenny Dalglish gave you the call about joining Blackburn? Did it make it an easy decision?
Yeah, Mike Walker was the manager, and it was tough for Norwich because they were at a bit of a crossroads. The supporters wanted to see, as supporters do, wanted to see the purse strings loosened and the chairman Robert Chase to spend and try and maintain that level of success. But that didn't materialise, and I signed a new contract, I think, just before Christmas of that season, and thinking that we were going to kick on. But then Mike Walker went to Everton. Rule Fox subsequently got sold to Newcastle United, and then, when that happened, I got on well with Rule, off the pitch. But, on the pitch, he was such a big part of Norwich City's team at that particular time. And you just felt that, even though it was tough, you felt the ambition wasn't quite there. And then, I had the, opportunity to speak to other clubs and the opportunity to move on. And I wasn't keen on moving on because I'd grown up in the city, and I like the area, but I couldn't not move on at that stage, really. You know, I had to be ambitious, and Blackburn, you know, were one of, I have to say, many sides at that particular time who came in for me. But Blackburn were showing real signs of ambition under Jack Walker, the chairman, and Kenny Dalglish. And Kenny Dalglish was brought in to bring success.
Yeah, you mentioned the clubs, Chris. You were linked with a lot of clubs at that time. So why Blackburn? What did Kenny Dalglish say to influence you to go there to Blackburn?
Well, to be honest, I couldn't understand him. So that was strictly not true. But no, I could have gone to United. I could have gone to Liverpool under Roy Evans. Ozzy Ardiles at Spurs have called up.
But did you speak to Ferguson?
I didn't speak to Alex Ferguson. Spoke to my father, who was a school teacher. But Norwich ended up agreeing a fee. It was a British record fee at the time with two clubs, and that was Blackburn and Arsenal, George Graham. And, you know, it was I had an attractive proposition from Arsenal, and the chance to play with Ian Wright, who was a player who I'd always admired. I'd played against him at centre-half when I was a Norwich player, and he ripped me to shreds, so I knew how good he was. But then the chance to play with Alan Shearer, and Blackburn had really pushed Manchester United that previous season and were going places. They were snapping up all the there was that best young talents around, you know, the likes of Tim Flowers, Paul Warhurst, David Batty had joined there, Alan Shearer had joined, you know, a year or two previously, and coming from Southampton, where he wasn't overly prolific at Southampton, but was a real physical handful. He'd gone to Blackburn and hit the ground running, and it was too good a chance to turn down the opportunity to play with Alan, the partner.
He was certainly established at Blackburn by the time you arrived. He'd scored over 30 league goals the previous season, but as you mentioned, like, you'd scored 25 Premier League goals the previous season. What was your attitude heading in then to pre-season that summer as to how that relationship, that partnership with Shearer was going to develop? Did you think you were going in on an equal footing?
I didn't really think of it like that. I was a young man. I think I would have been 21. I think 2021 when I joined Blackburn, and you know, essentially I'd gone in, and Alan had played with Mike Newell the previous season, and Alan and Mike were quite friendly. They used to travel in together with Tim Flowers, and you know, I essentially went in to play alongside Alan and take Mike's place. But, you know, at all big clubs, you have competition for places. All I was concentrating on really was getting off to a good start and, trying to develop relationships on the pitch, off the pitch with all the players. And, not just Alan, but obviously, you know, that was a big part of my thinking of going, to Blackburn Rovers. And fortunately... for myself, I got off to a pretty good start. We drew the first game I played away at Southampton, and then you go for big money, and people are questioning whether you I was worth a British record fee at that stage. And I found that hard to take, because at Norwich City, a smaller club where the expectations aren't there from the press, the media, everything had... You know, all I had was praise and adulation, and I loved it. You know, as you would when you're younger. You know, everything had gone so well, and then you go for big money, and then there's the question marks, start to come, which happened at Blackburn. But I got off the mark in my second game at home against Leicester City, and never really looked back from that.
Yeah, you know what? I think, yeah, you've maybe touched on something there that maybe I wanted to ask you about, though, Chris. You know, you mentioned the fee. You've also spoke about the personalities that was in that dressing room as well when you first gone in. And you said you've come from a club when it seems, maybe as an outsider from me looking in, real togetherness there at Norwich, real team spirit. And you're going into huge personalities along with that fee. Was there any intimidation then? Did you said that you just had to concentrate on your football, but that's easier said than done sometimes, given the fact is of the hype that was around that move.
Yeah, and you know, there's the big fee. You know, it's natural that pressure comes with that, and scrutiny. I have to say, I thought, you know, Kenny Dalglish as a man manager, you know, really helped me in terms of making the move as seamless as possible. And what I liked about Kenny as a manager, he would always back his players in the sanctuary of the dressing room. You know, he would be constructive. He would be critical. You know, at times he knew which buttons to push. But when he went outside and spoke to the media and the press, he always backed his players. And for that reason, I mean, it's similar traits to Martin O'Neill later on at Celtic, who I played with. He had the players eating out of his hand. First and foremost, you know, I wanted to sign for Blackburn, and Kenny and Kenny's footballing reputation, I mean, you'd understand this, went before him, and I was in awe of him as a player. But, you know, as a manager, I think he'd already won three league titles at Liverpool, and, you know, he was a manager who I wanted to run through a wall for.
The relationship then with Shearer and the level of understanding you got to at Blackburn that seemed to bring the very best out of both of you, was that something that was developed on the training ground? Was it something you would spend a lot of time talking about together? Or was it more just something that came about naturally?
Well, I think you develop through training and understanding. But, you know, I went into a Blackburn Rovers team which had really pushed United close the previous season. And I wouldn't say that this Blackburn team was the greatest ever footballing team which has won the Premier League, but we were extremely efficient. We were extremely streetwise. We knew our strengths and we played to them. We had two, you know, our wingers, Jason Wilcock, Stuart Ripley, really important in terms of service, crosses, getting crosses into the box. We had a good goalkeeper, Tim Flowers, solidity, centre-half, Colin Hendry, was a big Blackburn figure, and Tony Gale, actually. He'd come in from West Ham on a free transfer. He did a really good job in the first half of the season, and Ian Pearce stepped up. And then midfield, we had Tim Sherwood, who was a captain, a leader, a young captain, and was a really, really big, influential figure, and someone who, I mean, I used to clean Tim's boots at Norwich, but someone who I really looked up to. I thought he was a very good footballer, first and foremost. And then the player everybody forgets in midfield, because David Batty had a long-term injury. Mark Atkins. And Mark Atkins actually scored a lot of crucial goals for us that particular season.
Before we probably do get on, we'll probably get on to the Celtic time as well, but of course, you did have a big money move to Chelsea. There was a barren few years. You'd had that dismantling of the Norwich team. It was almost like a dismantling of the Blackburn side. It didn't go particularly well for a few years. Huge £10 million move, as I said, there to Chelsea. It was almost as if you'd had a few years where things didn't quite go the way that you certainly early career had gone up to, even your first couple of years at Blackburn. Then all of a sudden, then it seemed to change for you before you moved on to Celtic. So what happened during that spell then, last couple of years at Blackburn, and then on to Chelsea?
Yeah, well, Kenny moved upstairs, and I think Ray Harford took over as, you know, as manager. That didn't, you know, I didn't always see eye to eye with Ray. You know, I think he was a good coach, and things didn't work out for him as a manager. Roy Hodgson actually came in, and I really enjoyed my time under Roy at Blackburn. Ended up, I had a really fruitful partnership with Kevin Gallagher, and we were top of the league, actually, under Roy going into the new year. You know, after he took over, I think that would have been 97, 98, or certainly 97 somewhere. And we ended up getting a UEFA place. And, you know, I scored a lot of goals that season. I really... it was the first time, really, where, as a player, we'd had double sessions in training. And Roy was very, very meticulous, you know, a very... very good coach, and I really enjoyed my time under him, and had a good partnership with Kevin Gallagher. But then Brian Kidd, Roy ended up getting the sack, I think. But then Brian Kidd came in, and I'd had an injury. I think I'd had a groin injury for large parts when he was manager, and I ended up moving to Chelsea for, you know, big money under Gianluca Vialli. And it just didn't, you know, I don't blame anybody else. I think I lost a bit of confidence when I was at Chelsea. I missed a few chances on my debut. I think I let it affect me. As a deluded footballer, I'd sort of tell myself when I got up in the morning everything was all right. But it wasn't. And as a striker, the one thing you cannot do is hesitate. And I think that, you know, I hesitated at Chelsea. I let things affect me, and things, you know, didn't go well. It was nothing to do with the style of play, this, that, and the other. It was pure and simple down to me. And, you know, as a professional footballer, you know, it hurts. You want to play well. You want to be at the top of your profession. Yeah. And I, you know, things had gone pretty well for me throughout my career. And, you know, when I got into the Norwich first team, I felt everything was going to be a progression. And, you know, I was a hard worker. You know, I was glad to have the chance. Chelsea really knocked me back, but to be honest, I only had myself to blame for that. I signed a 6-year deal at Chelsea. Things didn't go well in the first year, and so I ended up moving, which, you know, in hindsight, the year at Chelsea may have been the best thing to ever happen to me in a really perverse way.
You know, you say the delusional footballer that's in you. I think probably everyone that I would have spoke to would have had it. It's almost if that you wake up in the morning, everything's fine. What did you do then? How did you maybe correct that? I know obviously you've moved on to Celtic further down the line though, but what during that spell through your Chelsea years, is that something you say you look back on and maybe it was maybe a good thing for you? But what were you doing differently? How were you maybe going about day to day? Were you doing anything differently from when you were at Norwich or at Blackburn? What was the dramatic change then?
I think I lost confidence in terms of finishing. And, you know, I spoke at the start of the programme about the likes of Shearer and Larsson. I don't know whether, you know, at Chelsea there was a time where I was frightened to miss. And you can't be like that. Shearer, he always portrayed you know, the image to me that, you know, he was ruthless, a ruthless individual in the nicest possible way. Henrik Larsson, the same. You know, and I think at Chelsea I missed a couple of chances. And that's the one position you cannot hesitate. You know, you have to anticipate, get yourself in, you know, in the box and whatever. And I think that, you know, I simply started to have doubts, maybe was frightened to miss. I think I was frightened to miss. And you cannot do that as a striker. And then, you know, as you quite rightly said, I think I was waking up in the morning telling myself I was okay, knowing full well that I wasn't. Now, all you can do then is knuckle down in training and, you know, practice your finishing, this, that and the other. But I think it was the one time, you know, I look back on throughout my career and, you know, disappointed with myself in terms of, you know, I shouldn't have lost confidence because I'd had so many years of doing well as a player, but I did. You know, I had doubts. I had, you know, things going on in my head, and you know, I clearly let things affect me. But you know, as I said, in the end, I think that in the best possible way, it actually helped me, and it helped me when I moved to Celtic really appreciate the career which I had playing football.
It almost sounds as though you had some sort of a footballing version of the Yips when you were at Chelsea.
I think that's you know, probably spot on. And you know, the truth is probably my all-round play was okay, but when you go for big money, which it was big money. I mean, nowadays, you know, it's absolutely crazy. Hmm. When you go for big money and you're a striker, you're expected to score goals, simply. And you know, I didn't score enough. And you know, you've seen Chelsea strikers, you know, over the years. You know, Torres, you know, has had a tough spell there. And you know, when you're in London, you play for a big club. That's what happens. It goes with the territory. And you know, now I've packed in, you know, I fully understand that it works both ways. You know, it's okay. You know, everybody likes getting the praise and the adulation. But, you know, sometimes you have to take a bit of stick as well. And I certainly got plenty of stick for my performances. And do you know what? Quite rightly so.
Their two seasons, so the relegation with Blackburn and then the move to Chelsea that doesn't work out, where you're probably, what, 25, 26, a moment in your career you probably think you're going to be at your peak. And then there's this real damage to your confidence. You get the move to Celtic. You're Martin O'Neill's first signing. Is that something he's quickly able to fix over a course of pre-season? Is that the power of Martin O'Neill, that he can turn someone's career around that quickly?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't give Martin all the credit. I met Martin at a hotel in Beaconsfield near London, and he just basically, you know, typical Martin, just said that, you know, he knows I've had a tough season at Chelsea, but it followed my career closely from a young age at Norwich. He thinks that I'm he thought that I was a top player, and I would be absolutely fine. Come and enjoy it. We needed to make a statement and really get close to Rangers, who were dominating and had been really dominant for a long period. At that stage in Scotland, and he wanted me to be part of that. And, you know, as soon as I met, and I had the opportunity, I could have gone to Spurs and I could have gone to Middlesbrough. To be honest, I didn't want to stay in London after, you know, the disappointment of Chelsea. And, you know, that wasn't a particularly difficult choice in that respect, albeit I had a lot of, Brian Robson was one of my favourite footballers growing up. He was manager of Middlesbrough, nice people. But I was really excited about the move to Celtic. I didn't know too much about Scottish football at that stage, other than Celtic were, you know, selling out 60,000 fans every week, and knew that, you know, they were a big club in that respect. I knew that Mark Viduka was, you know, had a good season, and there were problems with him and this, that and the other. He'd left, but I'd followed Henrik Larsson pretty closely, and I thought my style of play would maybe suit him.
Was it a similar betting in period with Larsson like it was with Shearer?
I was probably a bit more mature when I went to Celtic. I spoke to Henrik. We had a pre-season training camp. I think it was in Denmark. I spoke to Henrik, who I got on well with subsequently over the years, and just said, you know, I'm pleased to be up here. I'm pleased to be your partner. Let's get on. I'll pass to you if it's on. And I hope you pass to me. And
is that simple?
Moment, it was fine. He was fine. And I for 5 years at Celtic, I absolutely loved it under Martin O'Neill. And I really appreciated getting up in the morning and what I had then after the disappointment. Because nobody likes that when, you know, things go badly, and you know, things went badly for me at Chelsea, and you have your personal pride, and then there was pressure, you know, going to Celtic, which was a Scottish record fee at that particular time, and we all know that, you know, it's a great place to play, Celtic, and you know, that's the same at Rangers when things are going well, but you know, there can only be one winner in Glasgow.
Who was better then, Larsson or Shearer? You didn't answer that question before, really.
Well, I thought that Alan was ruthless, a brilliant finisher. You know, he really was. If you're asking who was a better all-round footballer, then Henrik Larsson was. He was the best footballer I played with. And Henrik Larsson could do everything. Henrik Larsson, where you'd say, you know, Alan was a number nine, Henrik Larsson could play in any of the three positions across the front. He could, you know, he could play in a 10. You'll be fully aware of, well, he played in Scotland, and it's easy in Scotland, which was levelled at him quite a lot. He scored a barrel load of goals for the Swedish national team, stepped up on the big European night for Celtic. And then when he went to Barcelona, turned the 2006 Champions League final against Arsenal on his head with a couple of really incisive, beautifully weighted passes, and that's what Henrik could do. Henrik had everything. Henrik could, yeah, he was a wonderful natural finisher. Both, you know, him and Alan, not the biggest guys, but superb. He had superb spring. Henrik did. He could see a pass. He could execute a pass. He was a real team player, and we built up a partnership. I had such a good understanding of how to play with Henrik, and that would be the best period of my career. Going out on the pitch, knowing whoever we played against, it didn't matter. We got good service from midfield, and we had a young Cillian Petrov who was really developing into a good player, bombing on from midfield and getting on in support, and I think that was the period of my career I enjoyed the most, because we had such a good team, such good understanding, and would dismantle the top teams all over Europe and dismantled Rangers.
When you did eventually decide to retire summer of 07, you were probably at an age where it was coming around anyways, but I was reading that...
you can't say that.
that it was at a time you'd been suffering some blurred vision, you'd gone to see specialists, and I'm just wondering how that developed and if it was something that was a major concern, if it's still a major concern. I was reading an interview you did recently where you were talking about your dad's battle with dementia. Obviously, we've had Alan Shearer doing the documentary on concussion and the issues that have developed with consistent heading the ball here in Ireland. We've had Kevin Doyle retiring because of concussion problems. Is it something you think about?
No, I don't. I don't think about it because I don't think it's sort of worth worrying about what's going to happen further down the line to myself. If something, dementia is something I, know a fair bit about because of my, dad who's suffering badly with it. But no, I mean, my retirement came around. It was actually Neil Lennon who started it. I went to block a shot. That was Gordon Strachan's first game in charge in Art Media Bratislava. And I went to block a shot after about 6 or 7 minutes. And as I was getting up, Neil was running across and he put his knee through my face. And then I'd fractured my cheek in four places. And it was subsequently the operation after where that was the first time where my sight, it was a problem, the vision in my right eye after the operation. And then it righted itself, it got better. Neil Lennon, by the way, was complaining to me that I hurt his knee. he was having treatment on his knee. But then I went to Aston Villa under Martin, and I got elbowed as against Manchester United. Paul Scholes has scored a brilliant volley. I think they've beaten us 3-0 at Villa Park in the game, and that was my last game. And I was 34 at the time, and I had a decision to make, and I'd seen three different specialists, and they'd all come to the conclusion that the sensible thing to do would be to retire because they can't fix. There's nothing they can do with my eye. They can't fix it, and so at that age, it was the sensible thing to do. Had it been 10 years earlier, I would have had a serious issue really in terms of a bigger decision to make.
We mentioned earlier about Blackburn's dressing room full of alpha males, a lot of personality, like that Celtic dressing room as well. You mentioned Lennon, Larson, Hartson, Paul Lambert. But I don't know, maybe just looking at Celtic slightly differently, it seems like that was a pretty fun dressing room as well.
Oh, absolutely brilliant going in the morning. The sense of anticipation, who would fire off something first. It was very interesting. It was a good dressing room. We had a good manager, a lot of strong characters, and it was a really exciting place to be, at the time. And what Martin achieved at Celtic was amazing, really, because he'd come in where Rangers had been so dominant, and this was a Rangers team at that particular time. They had the they had a big Dutch connection, didn't they? Arthur Newman, Van Bronckhorst, the De Boers came in, Michael Moles. I mean, it was a a really exciting time to be playing Scottish football. But you know, Martin, we made a mark really early against Rangers when we beat them 6-2 in the first Rangers game of the season, and then you know they beat us 5-1 in the next one at the Ibrox mine. But that gave us real hope and belief, and it was a really exciting time. And then the you know UEFA run and European football, and we built something. Well, I say we built. Martin built something special, and some of the European nights were just. I mean, they're the games I look back on in my career, and just standout games. I mean, they're still brilliant. You know, the Champions League, you turn up now before kickoffs, but and the atmosphere is incredible. But you know the years which you know Martin was there, we took some big scalps in Europe, and there was no better place to play.
Chris, you've been unbelievable with your time. You really have. There's so much we could actually get into. Your coaching career, your time back in Birmingham with Birmingham and Villa. Hey, no, you did all right there. Don't forget that. You did okay as well. And, you know, future plans, what you're doing now within the media as well. But I think the overriding fact, I think, from it all across the course of your career, and I would have watched you all the way through, even from a boy leaving school, watching your career develop, is why didn't you get more England caps?
I don't know that this is a loaded question.
It's not at all. I'm just thinking about the fact is and watching you and your relationships with strikers that you've played alongside, the goals that you scored, and the amount of caps. Is it one cap I think you got?
Yep.
Given your ability, it doesn't seem right to me.
Well, no. Well, I made it. I had a habit of shooting myself in the foot often throughout my career and saying what I thought of the particular time on the spur of the moment, and I'd actually had my first cap against Cameroon, and I'd played pretty well in the next 2 months before the next squad against Chile, and then it was Glenn Hoddle who was the manager, and he left me out, so he put me in the B squad, so I phoned him up stupidly and told him what I thought of the decision. But you know, looking back, I mean, what was I thinking, really? And you know, I had no right to do that. I knew that. And look, I was lucky to play, in an era when, there was a lot of competition for the striking places. You had Shearer, Sheringham, Les Ferdinand, Ian Wright, Robbie Fowler, Michael Owen had burst onto the scene, Andy Cole, you know, Stan Collymore, Dion Dublin. I mean, there was. I've probably left some out. David Hurst. Yeah. You know, there was so much competition for places. So, you know, of course, I would have liked to have played more. Would I have had more caps? Maybe. But you know, the sort of friendly situation became farcical, I think, in international football. In the big tournaments, I think the truth is, Kevin, that you know, there were people who you know were ahead of me in the pecking order, and that's the way it goes, but it doesn't get away from the fact I still, you know, didn't behave in the right manner once again.
Chris, you've been brilliant with your time. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, thank you very much. Thanks.
The board have made a mess of it. They are leaderless. They are rudderless, Darrell. It's like the People's Front of Judea. Nobody can make a decision. Meetings about meetings.
They will go and do things their own way, as they always do. So
oh, yeah, yeah. And they're doing a really good job, Stephen.
That's Chris's opinion.
And you're endorsing that. You're endorsing.
Well, I just don't have your opinion on it.
So they're doing a good job, then.
Everything you say doesn't mean to say Rangers have to go and do what you say.
So are they doing a good job, the board?
No, they're not, but they're trying to get the right one.
Well, you have strong views on Scottish football. What are the Aberdeen centre-half's names? You don't know them. You know nothing about. Well, keep your big nose.
Got no interest. Rangers will feel it's like a win, as they normally do when they get a point against Celtic these days.
Pedro, well done today. Do you honestly believe, though, you have the best squad in Scotland?
I always believe that. So how many coaches do you have in your life?
Well, which of the Celtic players wouldn't get in your team?
I'm not comparing my squad with any sort of other squads.
But if you have the best squad and Celtic are the benchmark, which of the players wouldn't get in your team?
You're welcome back to the football show. Nathan and Kevin in studio this evening. A text in from Dara, having watched and listened to Chris Sutton as a pundit. I was expecting him to be a bit of an arse.
But he comes across dead sound there. I don't think he was acting. I think maybe he's just sound.
Yeah, he's
just because he's criticised your team doesn't make him an ass.
Yeah, I know. Well, that's it. Yeah. What do you think of you and I?
Tells it like it is.
Yeah.
It's just what you get when you get those Celtic nations. They tell it like it is. Chris Sutton bookended one of my favourite football moments of the year, 2000. On his Old Firm debut, he scored twice when we beat Rangers 6-2. Some way to win over the fans from Chris in Newport. Yeah, and I think that was like his fifth game for Celtic.
Yeah.
Sort of Celtic in. He did point out they did lose 5-1 to Rangers a little bit later in the season. So listen, the 6-2 is the one that lives in the memory.
Exactly.
That's us pretty much done. We're going to talk to you again on OTB AM tomorrow, but also on Saturday. You're going to be at Manchester City against Leicester, so we'll chat to you about that. But OTB AM is back tomorrow morning, 7:45, Facebook Live, Periscope, youtube.com/offtheball. The Barryometer returns. But you should still tune in. It'll be Adrian Annone in studio with the 2008 World Rugby Player of the Year, Shane Williams. The lads will be talking Dublin football as well ahead of Dublin against Donegal this weekend. Tomorrow night, we've Dunica Ryan in studio. Johnny Ward will have some racing tips and a crappy quiz as well. Just time to tell you that tonight's winner of the competition, John Moore, who correctly answered that Serge Betson played for Wasps. Congratulations, John. You've won yourself a pair of tickets to the latest Off the Ball Roadshow at the Mansion House on Friday, February 23rd. If you missed out tonight, you can get your tickets right now at offtheball.com/events. It's the Off the Ball Roadshow in association with Heineken Rugby Club. Over 18s only. Drink Heineken responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie. Tom Dunn is up next. Good night.
Yard of grass, he'll give you a move for the perfect pass.